and welcome to the Lost Haro podcast. This is your podcast featuring me, your host, Arlen Haro, and my constant companion in this endeavor, Eric Sayor.
Welcome to the world of anime.
Yes. It won't be quite as bombastic or as intense as a visually moldable, but we'll get there. We'll try our best. We're talking about a director with a very small body of work, at least solo. I assume, like a lot of artists from Japan, he worked on a lot of stuff before. But Eric, do you want to educate people a little bit more than I can? Because I assume you know a degree more about this.
Satoshi Kon was an anime director that is very well known for his like psychological work. Sadly, he died very young from cancer 10, 11 years ago. So he only got to make a few movies, and all his movies have his movie, all his work has a reputation that's that kind of like cements him as maybe the greatest like animation director ever. Like it's like it's not an exaggeration to call him that. His work have like a incredible popularity in Japan, outside of Japan, and are directly like influential in a lot of Hollywood work we see today, like and we've seen for the last 2 decades since his work, from like Aronofsky to Nolan to even like even Edgar Wright is making movie that feels like a direct inspiration one of the movies we're going to talk about. An incredibly influential director, director that's been talked about, but that I'm glad I can kind of introduce to you in a way, because my quest to introduce you to the good parts of anime is still ongoing. We'll get there. His first feature-length film, Perfect Blue, is often talked about as one of the best horror films or one of the best films of all time. So that's the first one we're going to talk about, and yeah. I think it's a director that's really, really feels prescient in terms of like how his movies kind of portray the changing world, and how his like style inspired like so much of filmmaking today. So let's start with Perfect Blue. Perfect Blue is a horror, psychological thriller, I would say. That's the best way to describe it. It's following a hip hop idol in Japan that gets that retires from being a pop idol. She graduates, to use the word they use in that industry, which is kind of a fucked up word to use, but
I do want to do a little tangent here on pop idols. That is a very specific thing that maybe doesn't translate entirely to people that don't know about that culture. So I suggest looking up any of the number of documentaries about that subject, because I don't want to try and explain it or explain it poorly here. But it seems to be a very hyper specific thing to, I don't want to say all Asian countries, but it's very specific to Japan. And the way that they depict it in this movie, as far as I know, is very accurate. And yeah, it's interesting the way that they use entertainment to define who these characters are.
I think one of the most interesting thing about this movie and how it portrays like fame and obsession for fame is that it feels incredibly more relevant today when it's expected if you're famous to be entirely online and to have like all parts of your life be exposed, especially in terms of like online celebrities.
Yeah,
like from Instagram to TikTok to all those things.
Right,
it's kind of an expectation of openness, which leads to obsession and personality and expectations in a way that this movie portrays in such a prescient way. Like it's like it's like a lot of. That a lot of today's modern culture feels like it kind of directly descends in a way from that like pop idol culture that's like started in Japan. I mean, there's always been like obsession with celebrities, but but today it's like the expectation is to build this obsession in a way that's like kind of the less mystery there is, the more like friendly or like
yes
but like a relatable a celebrity seems, but it's like to the detriment of like everyone that those relationships are created. But in this movie like portrays that in so well.
Yeah, before the parasocial relationship became common, this depicts the downfalls and the ways in which a parasocial relationship can go wrong.
Yeah.
Again, to what you were saying about this being prescient. It just uses all that and it makes it feel somewhat relatable and human. And I think that's part of why this movie works as well as it does. The lead characters' struggles with just basic sanity don't feel removed in a dramatic way, which again is interesting with how that is reflected in the film and the way that the film is also examining that. This movie goes in some directions that both I'm sure that it goes in some directions I don't think that a Western movie would go in, and that I didn't expect an anime movie to go in. Like there's some real hard looking in the mirror stuff going on that I really
It feels like a criticism of that culture of celebrity, of the cult of celebrity, and like this becoming an obsession where the person you're obsessed with stops being a person and starts becoming like an object of imagination, where like you're putting on them like this imaginary being that is not and this becomes kind of literal in this movie. I think it's worth talking about like at least the setup and like kind of what happens in general, because it kind of helps understand like how this because this movie is really well constructed, I think. Even from the beginning, and it's also 1 hour 20 minutes long and feels like it goes by perfectly well and feels like it's never rushed. It's like I recently watched Black Swan, which is like kind of a remake of this movie in a way. I don't know if you watched that. I mean, Aronofsky is obsessed with Satoshi Kon and obsessed with saying he's doing homage instead of saying he's copying his work. But yeah, like Box One is like almost twice as long as this movie, and it feels like it's three times as long as this movie. At some points, so it's like there's something incredible for the brevity of Satoshi Kon's work. Like none of his movies is over an hour and 30 minutes, which I think.
But they never feel compromised by that.
Exactly. They never do. They never feel like they're too rushed, or they just feel like every moment that's shown on screen has like a worth put to it, which I feel like kind of is lost on like a lot of like modern longer movies have become longer and longer. But like I don't know. I feel like the movies there's an argument that I hear online a lot these days is that movies should be less than 100 minutes or longer than 200 minutes, nothing in between. So like an hour and a half or 3 hours, I don't want anything other than that.
I think that's a symptom of a lot of 2 hours and 20 minute movies that feel like they're 4 hours long.
Exactly.
And so many 4 hour movies coming out that don't feel long at all. So yeah. Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I was bringing that point to say how this movie manages to like introduce that character and her world and her entourage in a way that's immediately, even if you know very little about the idol world, you're immediately like understanding what this movie, like how these characters, like how the lives of these characters are going on. Like it's her last pop concert where she announces that she's quitting, that she's graduating, intercepted with like small moments of her life, her meeting with her agent, so they kind of know the small moment in the dressing room, and then her doing groceries and going home, and it's like the normalcy of that edited with like her on stage singing that pop song and the crowd cheering for her. And I think that's like there's like a lot immediately there, and you're kind of just put into that character's life. And it's also like a good indicator of like what level of celebrity we're talking about, because she's just going to the grocery store and there's no, and lives in a tiny apartment, and it's like there's no, it's we're not talking about someone that's rich. That's right, like, yeah. We're not talking about like a modern pop star that makes millions of dollars. We're talking about something that's really in between and closer to what we talked about earlier when we talked about like internet fame, where like 50,000 people know who you are, and that's kind of, and most other people have no idea what you're talking about.
It's a very specific level of I guess impact on the world. And again, like we were saying, or like I was saying, it's just, they managed to make her feel so relatable. And to not be overly specific, I guess. And I think, it manages to balance, like clearly withholding information with trying to maintain a mystery. Like that can go wrong. We've talked about that at length, mystery box versus other forms of storytelling. And this never does that. There's a clear understanding of who is who, and there's only a little bit of a misdirect, and I think the misdirect is handled very well and set up very well. And this is one of those movies where I'm probably going to rewatch it a couple of times, because I, like you're saying, I think the plot is really well put together and really well thought out. You know, it has those moments of, oh, I did not even connect that. I did not even put that together. But when you see it, you're just like, yes, of course that's who it is. Of course that's what the thing was. But then it also has these moments, and this is something that I really love it about animation as a format. It has these moments that are more obscure and more surreal. And I love the way that that just folds in and out of the movie so flawlessly. And it's handled really well, and it doesn't become, at least to me, it didn't become distracting at any point in the movie. It just felt like another tool in the canvas. So yeah, that was a nice thing that happened. But yeah, the plot, just to move on with that a little bit.
Yeah. So she received, like, she received in her fan mail a letter that that says that to go look up on the internet Mina's Room, which is a website she realized that is kind of dedicated to her, but also is like a journal made from the point of view of herself, where she's, where someone is literally spying on her and relating the moments of her life. So there's immediately like a stalker going on. We're kind of introduced to what we to that stalker character, who's like kind of obsessed with her, who's like a kind of a security guard at her last concert, and kind of gets in a fight with hecklers, and it's kind of always there throughout the movie. He's portrayed as like a kind of a disgusting man, with like really fucked up teeth, and yeah, he's like, I don't know. What did you think about like his appearance? Is like, I feel like in a modern movie, that's like, if in a live action movie, you can't really do that. Like, people need to look good in a way.
They need to look like human beings. Like, there's a degree of obfuscation and like almost memery with how much he fits the "this person is a troll" like idea. Like, he just does not. Yeah, there's a lack of verisimilitude with him, and I do agree. Like, in a modern animated movie or even in live action, to have somebody that looked like that would be a bit too much. They would try to soften some of his features, certainly. And even his interactions with people might come off as a bit overdone. Then again, I didn't think by that much, but maybe that's just how bad things got.
I think there's definitely kind of a mix of like how characters of which way the characters are portrayed is exaggerated by the perception of them. It's like, we get to a scene with a photographer who looks more and more sleazy the more that scene keeps going on, and like the traits in his face change, and there's a lot of like there's a lot of perception of character in the faces, guess it's like more indicative of like what kind of person and how they're perceived, more than it's like trying to look like actual people. I guess a lot of anime is that, and like, I don't know, we talked a bit about Masaki Yuasa's work. He's one of my favorite directors, and he does a lot of that also in his work, a lot of like kind of fucked up faces. That's kind of that goes all the way into the absurd. But this feels right. Like you're immediately supposed to think something about that character, and yeah. It's like it's never let go throughout. It's not kind of there to like trick you of anything. It's like he's like a fucked up stalker to all the whole movie.
He's instantly identifiable as like, oh, that person is bad. We don't know the degree to which he is bad, but he is not good.
So Mina, Mima, not
I think that's right.
Mima, it's like I feel like Mina is more of a regular name, but her name is Mima. Yeah. She starts her career as an actress, starting with like having a small line and immediately going from that to like her agent kind of lobbying the producers to give her a bigger role. Where she becomes, where her second scene is a rape scene, or scene where she's dancing in a cabaret and is just like raped by a man in the crowd, and it's like an immediate kind of jump. That's like that when you start the movie, you see that image of that character and. 20 minutes later, she's literally like you have the imagery of her being raped while people are cheering all around her. It's a very intense scene, and it goes and it's like it starts. This is the moment where it really starts getting to her. There's the stalker. We didn't talk about it, but when she was supposed to do her first scene, there was a letter that was addressed to her that was like a bomb that injures her agent.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. So there's the letter, then there's the rape scene, and she comes home and all her fish, she has an aquarium with a lot of tiny, cute fish that she really likes. And they're all dead, and she starts screaming, she starts crying. It's like it's a moment of like, I didn't want to do this, but like I'm trying to do this career and people are working hard to get me this career, and it's like kind of the moment she breaks. And then from there she starts getting these visions of like a mirror image of herself that's still being a pop idol, that's still like always in the pop idol costume, that's telling her that she's still the real Mima, still doing what Mima would do, which is sing. And at the same time, the website of her stalker start deviating from her life. It's no longer telling things as they're happening and as she's thinking about them. It's like going into like imagination and fan fiction, and like those two versions of herself are like this kind of become the same in her mind. What's happening on the website? What's happening? This version of herself she's seeing visions of. It kind of builds up in that way. There's a lot of
It starts to take like a physical form in a way, or at least the perception of a physical form. And the way that builds is very, it's very unnerving and it's very thrilling.
It works really well because you're seeing this buildup of like her own psychosis, her like losing her perception of what is real, what is not. She is doing more and more intense work. She's in the television series or movie. I'm not sure what it is, but
it's a movie.
The movie. Yeah. And she's getting. I thought it was a television series because there's a moment where the screenwriter, early on, that's like the producer says to the screenwriter, "You're gonna have to come up with the ending," and I feel like so that's more likely to happen. I feel like in television than in a movie, but it's like a. Like the movie she's shooting is a thriller, and like her character is also losing perception of herself, and what's happening to her character is being reflected kind of to what's happening to her in a weird way. And it makes us like it makes us and her like lose perception kind of what is happening and what's not to her, what she's doing. There's scenes repeating herself. She keeps waking up. Is what the scene we just saw a dream? Is it not? And at the same time, following the explosion, the murder starts to happen. First, the screenwriter who wrote the rape scene, he's found dead without his eyes, in an elevator. Then there's a photography scene where she does a shoot for a magazine, where she's shot entirely naked, and we see a scene of the stalker going in through like a magazine shop and buying every single copy of that issue and doing that in multiple places so that no one sees the image he has of Mima tainted by her being, I don't know, an adult actress. I'll say that. And I feel it's hard to say like how normal that is or was in Japan at the time. Yeah. It's like,
I tried to look into it actually. I was like, is this just a thing that Japanese performers and actresses do that just doesn't translate here? And I couldn't find any straight answers on that. So I have to assume it's a thing that that maybe happens.
Yeah,
a little bit differently.
Yeah, maybe it's that. Maybe it's just like also a kind of a publicity stunt to help her get like more popular as like an adult, like an entertainer for adults, like being in a psychological thriller, being accepting her body. Like she wants to distance herself as much as possible from her image as a pop idol. It's some of that.
It's a more extreme version of what Miley Cyrus has done over the last decade.
Kind of. That's like a good comparison. Like even someone like Bieber, it's like a lot of these pop stars that get popular very very young, trying to distance herself and kind of her build something of a career.
Outside of this sort of family friendly.
A family image of her. It's like that moment of breakage during that. But yeah, that the photographer is also found dead. And the way he's murdered is like his murder transitions to her shooting a scene where she's murdering a guy in the same way on stage. And at this point, you're like, we've lost all perception of like what is going on. Like it's like, okay, is she doing the murders? Is like the stalker an image she built? Like I feel like all these things are possible at that point. Like it's especially having seen movies that have similar buildup and have different like conclusion. I mean, we get the reveal in the TV series, which is like the character she plays in the TV series is doing some murders, but has multiple personalities where she's thinking that it was her as like that she was starting an acting career, but actually she was murdering. She was actually murdering people, but in her head it was acting. And like anyway, which is like. A reveal that's almost like, oh, this is what's happening to the character, but it's not. It's she ends that scene the whole production team cheers for her because she did a great job. She's like, they finished the work, and they that scene feels really good. Especially from like we see her projection, we actually see her like getting better as an actress as the series go. Mm-hmm. And that feels like a moment she kind of breaks, where she's like, okay, the that TV portion is done. I succeeded, and it's like kind of she like gets some control back. But then she's actually attacked by her stalker. Her stalker tries to kill her and rape her. She manages to escape.
On the same stage.
On the same stage where she's raped in the TV, other. The reason I think it's a television series is because people like fans are reacting in. Like we keep seeing those three fans of her old pop idol mm-hmm. group Cham, and like how they're kind of reacting to her career. I feel like it's like a television show, and that's why she can like get a bigger and bigger role as the show goes on. Since the show doesn't have an actual ending.
So what this makes me think, actually, and maybe you would know more about this. I have no idea. I wonder if in Japan they still do something similar to like the old school Doctor Who serials, you know, how those stories would be ongoing, but it was one story aired over weeks. And I'm wondering if, and that's kind of how anime storytelling is also done.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like, it's kind of like limited series right now, like closer to that extent, where instead of being shot, the thing is, a lot of anime is being worked on until the date it comes out. Like it's a last minute thing of it coming together. A lot of television can be closer to that, especially like 26 episodes show that come out like twice a year.
Just a thought. I think it could be something similar to that. It's the lines may be a little bit blurrier. I know very little about Japanese television, so
what I know is very limited to anime. So she's attacked. She manages to escape. Finds out we see that her agent that was waiting for her was also murdered at the same time, and her her manager, her like fan manager, who's roomie, who's an old, she used to be an idol star when she was younger, she's still kind of working with Cham, her old group that's doing really well without her. She finds her after being attacked and kind of takes her takes her in the car, tries to bring her to a safe place. But she says specifically in the car, I'm going to bring you to Mima's room. And we find out that she's the one that kind of was manipulating the stalker, like kind of started the blog, was emailing him instructions to do these murders, and she's the one that's kind of lost. Like, she thinks she is Mima. She thinks she's like the good version of Mima, and it's kind of hard to explain how like something like that can work, because they're characters that look different. But she's like. What we see her she looks the same as Mima, but in the mirror she looks like herself, which is like an older woman wearing a pop idol costume, trying to murder a young girl, a younger woman, I guess. Mm-hmm. And Rumi tries to kill Mima escapes, There's like a chase scene that ends in like the middle of the street where they've both been stabbed. A truck driver almost hits them, and we get and they're both like out of it. The truck driver calls an ambulance. It cuts off, and then we get an epilogue of Rumi being in a psychiatric hospital, still thinking most of the time that she's Mima. And Mima, who's like kind of become a successful actress at this point, being sad for her former manager, and kind of like it ends on a line that's like, "No, I'm the real thing. Like, I'm Mima." And it's that's it. It's like the thing with a work like this. It's like, there's so much imagery that's well used to portray like the changes of personality, of portraying there's a lot of like editing in between scenes, a lot of like the same scene happens twice in different ways, and you see her wake up in bed both times, and you can't distinguish what is a dream, what is real, in the same way she can't. And I mean that part I think is incredible.
Yeah, it's very thrilling. And I think it's very engaging. The way that it's animated and the way that the scenes feel, exactly the same. It's all very engaging in that way. So towards the back half of the movie, what kept coming up for me. And I was curious if this is something that came up in your mind on this watch, is I kept thinking of De Palma movies. And I think it's, and I was wondering how much of that is intentional. And I think it's very intentional. I think it's there in the fact
that
the thing that she's making is called Double Bind. and the fact that there's a character who dresses up as another person and tries to kill them. And there's just moments in this where it feels very De Palma. It feels specifically Body Double, which we didn't cover on the show, and Dress to Kill, which we did. I would not have been surprised if like an animated Michael Caine was in that mental institution that Rumi is in, because it has a very similar feeling. But I think there's like a sense of Brian De Palma's inherent like eternal hard on to his own work that isn't present in this. Like there's a different feeling to this, so that I didn't realize how De Palma this movie was until I got to the very end, where there's less of this sense of like, I don't want to say that De Palma is ogling, but it's if that is there, it's not as present here. Like there's a different viewpoint that this movie has about these events, but it's still thrilling in very similar ways, and it uses a lot of the same visual technique, but it's very cemented in animation, because there's certain stuff that De Palma does that wouldn't really make sense. A tracking shot doesn't really make sense in animation, but something I really appreciate about this movie is it manages to do the animated version of a tracking shot in a couple of places, or techniques that feel the same. There's a lot of use of reflection, which is also something that Palma really likes, but it's used so well here with these shots of like the floor being reflected, and stuff like that, and the way that characters will like move very rapidly, that's something that I think is extra effective in animation, the way that her stalker sort of just moves so quickly. I feel like I went off on some real rabbit holes there, but either way.
No, you're right. I definitely didn't think about De Palma in that way. I didn't really think about that, but you're definitely right that there is something there. I don't know if we will say De Palma invented that style, but he definitely like perfected it in a way and popularized it.
It's just his version of it is really what I'm saying. It feels very much like his. Like you could say that this is Hitchcockian, but it's the Palma's branch of Hitchcock is what
Yeah, there's a line in between there. There's also like some inspiration for like more like in more like Italian giallo work.
Yeah,
that's like absolutely. Really close to De Palma in that way. So yeah, no, you're definitely right. It's not something I thought about before. There's a I wanted to ask, what did you what did you think about the bath scene? Because that's like a scene that's been reproduced. That's like kind of iconic in this in the work. Is it something you even thought about while watching it? When she's like she's in the bath and she goes underwater and she screams.
When you pointed out, that scene does stand out. It's one of those moments, not to make too big of a comparison here, but it's similar to when you watch The Searchers and you see John Wayne outside the door and you realize that you that you've seen that.
You've seen this like 16 times before, right?
Yeah, it's in a Marvel movie, it's in a, you know, the list goes on. Like but it definitely has that feeling of like, oh wow, this has been in a lot of places. This has been replicated. I don't want to say to death because I think it's very effective when it's done well.
There's definitely a bath scene in Dress to Kill that's shot from over the top as well. Like it's like
yes,
which is almost kind of reinforces your point in a way. Yeah. This is a scene that's also kind of well known because there's a story of Darren Aronofsky trying to acquire the rights to remake Perfect Blue, mm-hmm. and he like, I mean, it's I don't know. I feel like I heard like a different things that he did or he didn't, but he did it just to get this exact shot in Requiem for a Dream. Because he does just the same shot in that movie.
Yeah,
it's not a movie I've seen, but I've seen that just like side by side thing. Mm-hmm. Anyway,
yeah, as a Tumblr boy, I certainly saw many photo stories of that shot in particular, and yeah, that checks out. Aronofsky being very inspired by this movie in particular is not a surprise to me, especially with when you brought up Black Swan. But the other one I feel like if I rewatched it again would probably have a lot of this in it is Mother, which we've talked about before, or at least how I've seen it. And there's a lot of similar use of just not being sure that you can trust what you're seeing or what you're experiencing. There's an aspect of that to both movies and a sense of a growing disconnect from the events going on around you that both movies make use of.
I feel like that's a good transition to talk about our next movie. Because we've dived deep in this, but the other movie we've watched is the second feature, Millennium Actress, mm-hmm. A movie that's centers around two documentary filmmakers who are trying to one the documentary director and one and his like videographer. We're trying to make a documentary interviewing an actress who used to be one of the biggest actresses of her time and kind of who removed herself from the world. It's a movie where she tells her story, the story of her life, kind of using the images from the movies she's been in. So she's been, there's, you get set pieces of moments of her life that are told to different eras of Japanese history, where she portrayed like a princess or a swordswoman or a geisha or from different times, different eras of Japan, and her pursuit of a man she met when she was younger, like in the early days or just before the Second World War, that was kind of hiding from the military because he was like an artist and kind of a rebel, anti-government. Yeah. She helped hide him for a night, and he left a key. He left a key in her in the house where she was keeping him safe when he went away, and she's been in pursuit of him her whole life, trying to give him back the key and kind of like just being in love with that image of him that's kind of always fleeting. It's a really fun movie because you get it's a really funny movie. It's a really fun adventure movie because you get you learn that the director of the documentary who's interviewing her met her when he was younger, and he was like he was working on at the studio when she was making movies, and he was already like kind of enamored with her and even saved her life once, and he's the one that found the key in the studio and is kind of returning it to her, and throughout like her retelling of her adventures, he kind of plays the role of the actor that's all the character that's always like kind of saving her and letting her pursue her quest by sacrificing himself. It's so you get all these funny vignettes of part of her life when she was young, when she met him, then like pursuing him while he was being pursued by the where he was pursued by the military, the military police, I would say. Her like crossing paths with him for a single moment, and then being interviewed by the police, and they get her because she admits that he was in her house. Like, she gets tricked to admit it, that she knows him, so she gets arrested. She gets freed because they caught him. She lives through like a bombing in her small town, where she finds out he left her a drawing of her, of the version of her when she was young. You get all these little beautiful moments of like kind of in a pursuit without end, like a failed pursuit, because the whole movie is her trying to find him at the end, and where he told her to meet her, when she gets there, he's not there, and you find out later that when he was captured, he was tortured, he never talked, but he ended up dying. So the movie, and in the end she admits what she was really in love with was the chase, it wasn't the man. She never really knew the man, but it kept her going throughout her life. And in the end, when she couldn't, she never got a chance to meet him, it kind of made her leave acting, leave that life behind, and she gets to relive it all one last time, telling those stories to the documentary filmmaker who has admired her his whole life.
Yeah, that's a pretty good summation of the movie. Actually, I don't think I can add anything to that. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's a much a very different movie. It's a movie that kind of, in the same way, like you said at the beginning, it kind of you're never sure what if you're watching a story, if you're watching the real thing. It's like because you're seeing scenes from movies past, like I said, intersected with like moments in her life. Mm-hmm. So you get very exaggerated versions of moment, and you get the documentary director like integrating himself, and sometime you cut off to like them replaying the scenes, and he's wearing like a funny costume, and she's like all into it, and the videographer is like kind of really done with it all, because he's like, what even are we doing here?
Yeah.
Until he gets really into it at the end.
Yeah, it's weird. So my closest frame of reference for a movie even similar to this, and this is going to sound real bad, is it reminded me a lot of the Muppets movies that they did. We've talked about one of them on the show before, where the Rizzo and Gonzo character play prominent characters, or they insert themselves into like Treasure Island or the Christmas Carol. And it has that similar feel of like, these are your two comedic, you know, they're the standard comedic character. They're the Abbott and Costello archetypes. But I do like that they're given unique characteristics, both of them. One of them is very bold and very like self-effacingly honorable, and like you said, the videographer is just so done. He's so tired, but I like the way that these two characters, they both, once they get into it, once they're in the middle of it, there are these moments where they not trade personalities, but where they like both get like really invested, or one of them gets really scared while the other one is suddenly now very invested. And I like the way that these, it feels so much like how real people interact when they're in these situations where, yeah, you may not want to be there, or you may feel like uncomfortable in a situation overall, but you still have these human moments where you're like, oh, what is that? What is that thing? How does that work? How is that happening right now? And they're, I like the fact that they're there to acknowledge the absurdity of the surrealism going on.
Yeah.
I love that stuff. I love those moments, and the way that they're so based in the characters, and even the performances, you know, like the vocal performances are so strong. And this is why I always have, you know, sort of gone with the, you know, dubs over subs direction, you know, when I have had to watch animation, because there's something in the way that these characters in particular play their characters that is very engrossing and makes this movie incredibly watchable. And then just the visuals are absolutely gorgeous in this movie. I think all of his movies are absolutely gorgeous, but this one, there's something about the visuals and the way that it changes only subtly from time period to time period or movie to movie, but still manages to fit the individual story that they are sort of vignetting. And then also something that I am particularly a fan of is use of score and intelligent use of score. And I like that this score doesn't try to be one thing. It's heavily synth, but it's also heavily classical, and I love the balance of that and the way that it's so dependent on the characters and what part of the animation you're seeing. And it's a really, really well done score that helps to illustrate the emotions of the movie without trying to lead the audience in one direction or the other, letting the content bring you where the content is supposed to go. If it's not clear, I really like both of these movies, but this one in particular, it hit in some interesting ways.
Yeah, this is This is just such a fun movie. This is a movie I've rewatched a few times just because it's so... It's really just like a great fun watch. It's like it's a good adventure. I mean, the ending is sad. Like it does end with her finishing to tell her story and collapsing, and she just in the hospital telling the doctor, the director of the documentary, Genya, that she's lived her life fully, and that's what she always loved, having the chase she had. Has no regret about that. It's kind of inspired by the life of two actresses that I don't I know one of them because she's worked with Ozu, but the other I've never heard about. The actresses are Setsuko Hara and Hideko Takamine. I mean, it's kind of inspired by their like kind of well-known work, and there's really a feeling of trying to honor like the work of actors. There's something in both these movies where by having like real life intersect with like the what's happening on screen when they're acting, it feels, for me at least, like he's kind of honoring the work of actors and like how what they manage to bring and how they manage to do that work and separate the two while not completely separating the two, because you can't really. And
right.
And I think that's like very like that it feels like there's some admiration there for that work, and I really like that.
Yeah, there's a sort of, to put it, you know, going off what you said, there's like a respect for the distance, and the way that distance is used. And like the way that this character is defined, both by the scenes we see that are not meant to be in a particular movie the character's working on, and the way that the scenes where she is playing somebody different, the way that those both inform who she is as a person. There's just something about that resonates emotionally, and it all goes towards creating a full character, while just continuing the premise of the movie. It's a very complicated act, I feel like, but it's, I think it's handled exceptionally well.
And it's like what this movie really does manage to do is kind of balance the tone really well of the comedy, but also like the emotion of the characters. Like you get the beautiful moment of her finding the drawing of herself on the wall with the words "We will meet again" written next to it. You get the moment where you cut to the actress in her old age and she's crying because she can't remember his face. You get that line at the end of what I really love was the pursuit of him. It's like all these small, beautiful moments, I think, are what kind of that intersected with the humor, intersected with like the human moments of connection, of like him also telling her his story of him in his young age as a PA working for the studio. It's I think it's another great Satoshi Kon film.
Absolutely. I guess the last major thing I have to say, sort of on that note, is like, I really like the way that they talk about, you know, history sort of colliding, and, you know, how people's lives affect each other's, you know, I think it's like his father or his uncle who's in one of her earlier works or directs one of her earlier movies, if I got that, if I understood that correctly. And I like the way that that character gets to not the way that you can in time travel movies sometimes, like, see them like saying something that is counterproductive to what they would say to you in real life. Like, there's those moments are also really well handled. Yeah, and I, just the whole thing of, you know, seeing somebody from a different perspective, but that doesn't, it doesn't entirely change how you see them. It just shifts it slightly. Those are moments that I found also really impactful. And then one last character I want to just point out really quickly is I like the way that they handle the jealous older actress. I really like the way that she's handled. She's given a lot of compassion, compassion that I don't think you would normally give that character. Sometimes that character is really given the short end of the stick. But I think that she's handled really well. Even when she reveals some like really like terrible things that she's done, there's still a sympathy for the character that I really admired.
Yeah, I agree. I think both these movies have those moments as well. They're both like kind of centered around women that have a very different relationship with the older actress they're working with. I mean, Perfect Blue doesn't really get into like it more than like the older actress being kind of supportive and also kind of tired that she's still dealing with a person with no experience. Whereas Millennium Actress is really there's like this relationship of jealousy and like, but it's like you're right that it does leave the place to the older actress to like for us to like kind of understand her. It's like there's empathy for her in there, but I think there's just a little bit of like kind of this is how women are going on there, that's like maybe a little bit too much, but I don't know.
Sure.
It feels like it feels less bad. Like I said, it doesn't feel as bad as it could have been because like you said, there's a lot of empathy for that character and there's a lot of like it gives her the time to have her moments as well. But there's something in there in the way that that's like that's I feel like something that's always been it feels like it's something that's like been put on screen multiple times, like like there can always only be one successful woman,
right?
in that weird like kind of sexist way, and I feel like it's kind of a trope that's not as interesting as and not really like I think it kind of works here, but it's like I don't know,
right? Yeah,
it's not what the movie does the best.
I agree. Like the base thing that they're addressing there is like it's not great. It's just like kind of overdone, but relatively I think it's impressive on the spectrum, I guess. But yeah, no, great point. That's a very good point. I don't have like a lot of like other deep things to say about this one, but if you had other
I think the first one is a movie with a lot more depth, whereas this is more kind of everything is kind of on screen, like all the love for the cinema, I mean, this is a movie that's kind of in love with the history of Japan cinema. Like it's all about honoring that. And like, even up to like from the, like there's some Godzilla scenes. There's some, scenes from every period of Japanese history that can be portrayed. there's a lot of love there for Japanese cinema, and it's like, it's just such a film that feels so alive and full of like, having its emotion on its sleeve, and I think that's why it really works well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a movie this is something I've run into a couple times throughout podcasting in general. It's a movie that it would be very easy to just say, oh, that was fun. That was nice to look at. That was like, it would be very easy to just be like, oh, that's very good. That's very well done. I have nothing really to say about this. It's just a very well presented movie with the, and I think it's very thoughtful and well put together. So
I think the one sad thing about this movie is that it's not really available on physical media. There's no Blu-ray of it really, or there's been a demand for it forever. I'm really glad that it's on Criterion channel right now. So if it's something you haven't seen, it's really worth looking up, because it's not a movie that's that easy to find in the best quality, I think. It's one that I kind of wanna. It's one of those movies that like I said at the top, that I've watched a few times and that I always love, and that I kind of wanna. I wish there was like a nice Blu-ray version of it.
Yeah, I would. I think I would buy all four of his movies right now, even having only seen three of them. I would definitely do that, because I would love that. I do want to point out, and I don't know if this is the same internationally, Millennium Actress is available on YouTube in the States here for free. So if this is not a movie that anyone has seen before and you want to watch it here, watch it there. It might not be there for a long time. There are lots of movies that are free on YouTube for like a month and then they go away. That's a thing that people can do right now after listening to this podcast. Yeah. Actually, I won't mind if you pause and just go.
You'll look at the time. There's like 2 minutes left. You don't need to pause and come back. I feel like we'll be talking about Satoshi Kon's other movies very soon. Tokyo Godfather and Paprika, both movies I have not seen that I'm really excited to see, maybe one day we'll talk about Paranoia Agent as well, but look forward to in a couple of weeks when we are back on Satoshi Kon coverage. Anyway, let's do some plugs. I think we've gone around these movies. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram I'm at ECR, and you can write us an email at lostharopodcast@gmail.com. Tell us what's your favorite Satoshi Kon movie. Tell us what's your favorite scene inspired by his movies.
Absolutely. Please do that. By the time this is out, there should be a way too long After Dark released, an episode I do not remember. I do not remember what we talked about. I struggled to do the art for it before recording this today, so go listen to that once it's out, as soon as this is out. That's my plugs, and we will be back with more Bond and other stuff going forward.
Yeah, we need to do all these other Bond movies at some point.
Yep. Mm-hmm. We're gonna get them out. We're gonna do it. Bond might move again. You never know. So
all right, anyway. Bye.
Bye.